Tonight on Arena, Nancy Harris on the new Everyman production of her play The Beacon, and Lonnie Jordan, founding member of the American funk band War, on their Dublin performances. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Fans of Irish drama on stage and screen will know the work of Nancy Harris, writer of the hit RTE TV show The Dry and plays like Our New Girl earlier this year at the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. Dark family drama underpins a lot of her stories, including The Beacon, a play first commissioned by Gary Hines and Druid Theatre Company back in 2019, but now getting a new production at the Everyman in Cork. The Beacon is a psychological thriller set on an island off West Cork, where Beave, a high profile artist, has made a new life for herself in the family holiday home. But the peace is soon disturbed by the arrival of her estranged son and his new American wife. The reunion gives way to rows, accusations, not least of which concerns the unsolved disappearance of Bev's ex-husband and Colm's father. Delighted that Nancy Harris joins me on the line this evening from London. I'll come to the play presently for sure, Nancy, but I just wanted to ask you a little bit about The Dry. I think even before you came to speak to us in the last 5 or 10 minutes, you have been working on rewrites for season 3 of The Dry, the final season.
Yes, I mean, well, we're always, once we're filming, we're still in rewrite land, because it's kind of, even though all the scripts are there, it's kind of a moving parts. It's a live animal, really. And so little changes are being made, little tweaks, and sometimes bigger tweaks, depending on where we're at.
I think I spoke to yourself and Paddy Bradnock, the director, certainly before the second season, possibly even before the first season. I think it might have been back then. And I remember being really struck at the time how The Dry manages to hit this mix of very serious topic of alcoholism within a family and with one particular member, maybe more than one member of the family. And and yet it's very funny in the way it does it. We laugh and we feel pain for the characters involved. It's quite a feat to have achieved over the first two seasons. And I presume the same balance will be there in the third season.
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's interesting because I always worry a bit when we talk about the alcoholism, that it's going to make people feel like it's depressing. And actually, I think the show, while we do hit hard, we also, it's really important to me that it's light and funny and fun. And actually, as much as it is about alcoholism, it's really about just family and the human struggles that we all have in life. In relationships.
Yeah, and you know, the great cast that you have in there, Siobhan Gallagher, or Roisin Gallagher rather, calling her by her character name, playing the character of Siobhan. Pom Boyd as her mother, Bernie, Siobhan Cullen as her sister, Caroline Adam, John Richardson as her brother, Ant, Ciarán Hinds as the dad, Tom, and Mo Dunford as an ex-boyfriend of Siobhan's. I mean, it's quite a cast. Particularly as you come into the final season now and you're finding some kind of resolution, if that's what you're looking for, within the story of all of these, the stories of all of these characters, how much have the actors playing the roles started to shape or totally shaping what you're writing, Nancy?
Well, firstly, you're so right in what you say there. They're all heavy hitters, and a lot of them are leading actors in their own right. You know, Ciarán Hinds, Roisin Gallagher, Siobhan Cullen, Mo Dunford, they've all played leads. And but the fact that they kind of come back and want to be part of an ensemble is huge. And the way that Paddy has kind of organised that has been really beautiful as well. But I would say they've fed into so much of how I write and in the way I write, because I can hear all of their voices. But I think the story has probably, it's probably always stayed a bit separate. But what I feel is that each of them, they all bring some, they all have such individual qualities that I want to kind of write into them or challenge them or say, I've never seen this actor do this, so I'd like to see, try and do it this time. And they all have such a facility for comedy and for tragedy. Like, they make it look very effortless, which it isn't. It's not effortless to walk that line. It's really hard.
Yeah, that is the trick, to make it look, you know, I'm not acting at all here, sure. I'm just being myself, which is one of the most annoying criticisms I ever hear people saying about an actor. Oh, he or she is just being themselves. No, they're being the character that looks like themselves. It's called acting.
No, and they're such technicians, and they really, like, they pore over that script. You know, they can deliver a gag and then in the next beat deliver a devastation. I mean, you know, watching Ciarán Hinds, watching Roisin Gallagher, watching them do it is really extraordinary. It's such a gift to be able to write into that. And I think probably where they have really facilitated me is that I felt braver because I know they're a brave group of people.
Generous of you to describe it in that fashion. I'm sure they would throw that compliment right back at you. It's not surprising that you should refer to the major theme of The Dry, in fact, being about the difficulties of family life, and that is certainly there.
I have a theme.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think we can say that safely. It's certainly there in the beacon. I suppose the family is the ultimate kind of cauldron. It's the ultimate kind of crucible for drama to take place.
It is. I mean, it's all the great, you know, American dramas, Irish plays, you know, they're always really about family. The Greek tragedies are about family. Aristotle, when he was writing the Poetics, you know, he mentioned that family is, it's where we have the greatest amounts of stakes. So I think as a writer, when you lean into family, you know that the stakes can be really high, and that we can't get away from our families. Do you know what I mean? We all have to live with them and love them. But it's, you know, I think that is what kind of makes it so rich as a playwright, rich territory. And I like kind of going into different aspects of it, like whether it's maternal ambivalence or like you were mentioning Our New Girl, which was my play, which I think sort of has a relationship to The Beacon, even though Our New Girl was set in London, was about a London woman who basically was ambivalent towards her child. The Beacon also has a very strong female character in the centre of it, who's played by Geraldine Hughes in the Cork Everyman production. And she is quite a challenging mother figure, I think.
What a nice way of putting it. A challenging mother figure. By the way, say the character's name, because I was terribly unsure. B-E-I-V is how it's...
Maeve, but with a B.
Maeve with a B. Bave, that makes
Maeve,
total sense. Yeah, when you say it in that fashion. She is certainly a challenging mother figure. Not least of the challenges within her personality is the fact that she is an artist and a reasonably successful visual artist. What does that bring to the character? What did it allow you to explore in this play? Because it's a very important theme, I think, within the play.
Yeah, I mean, I think artists are challenging parents because artists' job is to tell the truth and often to talk about themselves and often to challenge things that are deeply uncomfortable. And I think for children, there's a degree to which we'd like to not really know our parents at that level of intimacy. And when your mother is kind of a feminist artist and she makes a lot of kind of sexually explicit work, she's lived quite a wild bohemian life. For her son, it's kind of anathema. He just does not want to know about it. And he's kind of, in retaliation, become quite conservative, has moved to America and is living quite a normal life, working in the tech industry and has married this girl to sort of get away from the artistry and all of that, in a way.
Bave has a very interesting line. Well, she's loads of interesting lines, but one that jumped off the page at me was when she says to her son, Colm, "I was a ferociously selfish mother." Is that a necessary quality for an artist of any kind, not just a visual artist? I mean, do you even find yourself at times having to be selfish as a writer?
I do think it's selfish. I mean, as myself, I think I can be, because your first obsession is with your work. Well, I certainly find that, like, it's your first love in a way, and you give everything to it. You give up, you know, you were talking about The Dry there, like, I've been working three weekends. I took one day off for Christmas, you know, and I love it. It's kind of thrilling, and it's no sacrifice, but it can be very irritating to people that love you, people that are close to you, who are like, what is this obsession?
Yeah.
And I think artists are just driven. It's a compulsion. It's something within us. And, you know, and particularly somebody like Bave, even, who's a visual artist, that they're always, their first love is going to be that work. And she's not going to make it nicer because her son finds it uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I think that's the challenge of an artist.
And
start to manage the work, you're not telling the truth in a way.
Yeah, and when we are meeting, Colm is the son and Bave, the mother and son characters, they haven't, it's not that, estranged might be too strong, but they certainly haven't seen each other for a long time, and there's a lot of stuff from the past that's kind of there in the background. It really struck me about that thing about families. You know, I often thought, how come in a family somebody can say, pass me the salt, and it has years of history in behind it, and it can mean a million and one other things. Family dramas allow that, don't they?
They do. Well, it's like the way, you know, you go home for Christmas and you suddenly revert to being a teenager, and you might be 40, but you're like slamming doors and getting furious. You know, we all go back to, there's like a default button with a family or a reset. And I think that that's very much the case. And in this play, in this piece, Bave's ex-husband, so she wasn't actually married to him, she was separated from him, but they had a very close relationship. He went missing at sea. And it's believed by locals that she had some involvement in that death. And her son certainly believes it. And so it's about a son who sort of doesn't trust his mother, as well as kind of finding what she does kind of awful and, in, you know, too much for him to take. He also believes she's possibly capable of something really terrible.
Yeah, and the other aspect of this story is that there's a podcast, there has been a podcast, and there's a desire to make more podcasts about that particular ambiguous death, shall we call it, that is present in the story of your play, The Beacon.
Yes.
What were you listening to around the time of writing, or were you listening to every murder mystery podcast that was out there?
I got really addicted to murder podcasts around the time of Serial, which was about, I don't know, over 10 years ago now. And then I started listening to them all. And obviously this play is set on an island off the coast of West Cork. And, you know, there was the famous West Cork podcast, which actually came out after I had started writing the play. But it just, you know, it just goes to show that it was such a popular, true crime is such a kind of, became such a huge genre that it felt that, of course, a character who was believed to have done these things would elicit a podcast. Yeah.
And it brings up an interesting dilemma in some ways, in that an artist, as the Bave character is, wants their work to be seen, you know, and in some ways is displaying themselves on a regular basis in whatever painting they make. Or in your case, I suppose, we could argue that anything that is on the page of this play, or indeed on the screen when we see the dry, there's a big chunk of you inside of that. An artist wants to be seen. But they may not want, or would they want, a podcast to be made about their potential involvement in the death of their ex-husband?
Well, artists, I think, want to be seen, but also I think they, it's a way of sort of obscuring yourself as well. And Bave is an interesting one because she's building a house that she's made of glass. So she's sort of inviting people to look in at her and say, I have nothing to hide. If they're going to talk about me, if they're going to make podcasts, I'm going to let them see everything. And yet she doesn't actually tell her son everything. And her work is not work. It's not, you can't definitely say this painting is about this thing. That's all suggestive and it's abstract. And so the truth in art as in life isn't a fixed thing often. And it's more nebulous. And so, and she, while she proclaims to be very honest, she also is concealing something from her son.
Yeah. And well, probably a little bit from herself, potentially. But that's a whole other psychological road that we won't go down just for the moment, because we could get lost down that rabbit hole. But I do think there is the other aspect to this, which is you mentioned in terms of the dry, how you didn't want it to be a play that people say, oh, this is about alcoholism, it's going to be terribly heavy. You wanted to have a light touch and you wanted the fun to be in there. I have to say, in the opening sections of the play, where you have this young Californian girl, or she's a young woman who comes home with the son to meet this artist whom she knows of and whom she reveres to a certain way, you have great fun. You poke fun at how people read things into paintings that may or may not be there. Was there something you wanted to say about, I suppose, modern and conceptual art and how there can be quite a toffee-nosed approach to it and an over-intellectualization around it?
Well, I think it's not just art, or it's the theatre as well, of which I'm very much a part. But like, there is a degree to which people can view us and think we take ourselves very seriously and none of us have any sense of humour, or, you know, that it's a very important thing and theatre must be treated like eating broccoli for dinner. Do you know what I mean? When actually, I think we should go to the theatre and enjoy it and be challenged by it, but also, you know, like it. I mean, that's and we can have fun and we can laugh. And so for me, I always think comedy is a really important way of actually bringing people in and relaxing them, and then you can kind of hit them in the guts a little bit.
After you've relaxed them, then you give them the punch. Yeah. That's a lovely boxing metaphor that you have there, Nancy.
It does tend to work, and it also, I think, I mean, it's interesting. Sarah Joyce, who's the director of the Everyman production, she really felt like she wanted, like one of the things she said to me when we first started working, she goes, I want to get actors that are capable of bringing that comedy, because she felt it was important to the writing. And I think if it was all dark, it would be relentless. But there, and also Bave herself has a bit of a sense of humor. She's sort of poking fun at things as well.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, and I know it's a kind of a cheap joke, but I roared laughing when I read it. The character is called the young wife, the new wife is called Bonnie, and one of the wags at home, one of the pals at home, says, "Oh, does she lie over the ocean?"
Yes.
Did you name her Bonnie because of that, or did you think of that along the way?
I think I thought of that along the way.
I did, I have to say. And it's that, there's that kind of humour in there, but there is also that darker kind of commentary on how sometimes we do take ourselves a little bit more seriously in the arts world than perhaps people do in other worlds. But the other thing I wondered, having said, asked you that question about the dry and, you know, working with the actors across into this third and final season, it is definitely the final season, by the way, is it?
It is. I mean, it's very sad. It is the final season. Yeah.
Well, OK. Yeah. But coming back to the Beacon, the play, I wondered when you revisit the play, 2019 was commissioned by Druid at that time and it got its first production then. Here we are 6 years later. Do you go in and retweak some stuff? Do you change anything on the basis of the new cast and the new production that it's getting? Are you as involved as you might be in a first production?
You're never quite as involved as you would be in a first production, because in a first production, you really don't know. You know, you're really putting it up on its feet, and actually you're really testing the play at that point. And so in a way, the first production is the first time you really encounter the play. And actually you do, the more you see productions, the more you kind of understand your own play. It's a very strange thing. But I have tweaked little things, because even in the 6 years, our attitudes to podcasts or online, the language has changed a little bit. So I've tweaked certain things, nothing plot-wise, nothing character-wise, but just little things like that make it just a bit more contemporary.
There must also be a certain joy, and I'm not quite sure what other adjective I could use to describe it, but the feeling around bringing it, here it is now in the Everyman in Cork, and the setting is West Cork. Is that adding layers to it in some ways?
It is, really is, because all of my family are from Cork, all my family. My uncles, aunts, my parents are both from Cork. My dad actually acted in The Everyman in the 60s. And so that theatre has such a history. And so Des Kennedy, I think it's really exciting what he's doing. He's taking over. So I was thrilled.
But Des is the new artistic director. I think this is his first year there, isn't it?
It's his first year. And he rang me and he said he wants to do plays that have a real connection to Cork. So, which is like, it's phenomenal. And I'm really excited about the fact that there'll be a Cork audience seeing a play that's set in Cork about Cork. And also I'm terrified, because I'm like, I hope I got this right. I think I did, but like, you know, it's a different thing to be encountering this audience and to be telling a story completely set. And I know they'll all know Shirkin Island and Cape Clear Island and places like that. You know, that'll be very familiar, and that's where the play is kind of set.
And will they all be looking for themselves, or presuming? I know.
Or going, how dare you say that there are people that may or may not have murdered their husbands living on these islands, ex-husbands.
Can writing happen in the midst of this type of activity? You know, you must be, you know, knee deep, as I say, in rewrites for the dry, and then this production going on, which you're maybe not as involved in as you would be in a first production of the play. But the Cork aspect clearly is going to be very important to you, given the familial collections. Can writing on new material, is there any space in the head for that?
Well, I feel like I should say that, to be fair to the Everyman production, they while I've been mostly in London, I've been in daily contact with Sarah Joyce, the director, and the cast. I met them all on Zoom and stuff, and I'm going to see them this next week. So I'm definitely a part of it.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it is a different thing when it's not the very first production.
Yeah.
No, at this moment, I couldn't be writing a new play. I just, there isn't really the time in the rewrites, and with this coming up now as well, because I'll be going over to Cork for dress runs and for previews. So I'll be very much a part of that.
And then the selfish Nancy Harris will kick back in when that all quietens down and says, no, I'm not available for anything now.
No, no, I'll be just delighted to get back to, I'm looking forward to having to actually writing another play. I am looking forward to that. But the other thing is, sometimes when you're so busy, you forget to stop and go, this is the whole point.
Yeah.
You know, and to try and enjoy it as much as you can.
Yeah, well, particularly when it's a screenplay or when it's a play, there's no point in having it on the page. It has to get onto the screen or it has to get onto the stage, or in some ways it kind of doesn't exist. Nancy, yes. Lovely to speak with you. Thanks so much and best of luck with all the final season of The Dry and indeed this new production of The Beacon, and hope to see you and hear about the new play again soon.
Thanks, Sean.
That's Nancy Harris, and Nancy's play The Beacon previews at the Everyman in Cork from the 4th of July, opens then on the 8th and it runs through until the 19th. You can find out full details on everymancork.com. Now, formed in the late 1960s, multi-platinum selling band War became known as the original street band, using music as a tool for social commentary and cultural connection. 50 million, over 50 million records sold, and a catalogue that includes timeless hits like Lowrider, that we were listening to just before the break there, The World is a Ghetto, and Why Can't We Be Friends. War's influence stretches far beyond the charts. This year, the band, still led by co-founding member Lonnie Jordan, is celebrating the 50th anniversary of their landmark album, Why Can't We Be Friends, with a global tour, and the band will be playing the Academy in Dublin on July the 2nd. Absolutely delighted to be joined from, I believe, Tennessee in the United States of America by Lonnie Jordan right now, and producer Jerry Goldstein, who's been there with War almost from the very start. But Lonnie, I was just thinking as I was listening to All My Friends Know the Lowrider. I mean, that sound that you guys, and that wonderful sense of fun that was in the music 50 years ago, it sounds as fresh today as it must have done back in 1975. How is it for you performing those songs 50 years later?
It's just as exciting as it was 50 years ago. And by the way, we're not in Tennessee. That's Adam that called you earlier.
All right.
My tour manager. We still live in L.A.
All right.
So where the Lowriders started.
And just give us a sense of, you know, the beginnings of that song, Lowrider, and what kind of the mix of musical sounds that are there within it. I mean, there's that wonderful rhythmic section that we hear going on, the saxophone and the horns, almost like car horns at times they sound like in the midst of the song. The mix of sounds that you were looking for in a War.
Well, that's a harmonica, by the way. Mm. Harmonica and saxophone. Mm. Yeah, that was our sound, and it's always been our sound from the beginning. And that's pretty much what Jerry Goldstein's on the other line right now. He's he was the and still is producer, and he produced pretty much with Chris Huston the created the sound. Of that, which started with Eric Burden breaking down our band into like two horns. We used to have like a bigger horn section back in the early 70s before Eric Burden got with us, and he broke it down to saxophone and harmonica. And Jerry Goldstein took that creative moment and made it what it is today.
Yeah, and it was Lee Oscar, of course, who was the harmonica player, Danish harmonica player, in the midst of all of that. But that mix, Jerry Goldstein, that mix of the harmonica and the saxophone, it really stands out in the midst of that track, along with all of those other elements that I mentioned, the wonderful rhythm in behind, and that voice, Lonnie's voice with All My Friends Know the Lowrider. As a producer, you must have jumped up and down with delight when you heard that sound starting to come together.
Yeah, well, actually, the jam was 45 minutes long. And seriously, and there was a little section in it about 8 minutes that I thought was really cool. So I gave everybody a tape after we cut the jam at the end of the session. And the next day, Charles Miller, our sax player, shows up in his lowrider, which he just bought, by the way, an old Chevy. And, you know, he came up with an idea for the song, and I went, nah, I don't think so, but why don't we write a song about lowriders? So we started writing what a lowrider is, et cetera. And then the rest of the guys came into the studio, and everybody sort of got into it. And Charles went out on the mic, and he sang the song. And, you know, and it was like there's a lot more verses. Mm. If you actually, in the 50th anniversary, is the long version unedited with all the verses.
So you said it was a 45-minute jam. How long is the long version when the guys would perform in Dublin?
8 minutes. And they play it for about 8 to 10 minutes now, you know.
Yeah, and it strikes me, Lonnie, I mean, even as I listen to the 3 minutes and 9 seconds version that I have, which is obviously the version that was on the record at the time, but it strikes me that there is that sense of what Jerry was just talking about there, this sense of a jam, this sense of almost as if you're playing absolutely live in front of us or on the record itself. I wouldn't think that there was a lot of post-syncing or anything like that done. These feel like live performances always.
Well, it was. It was all a jam. And Jerry Goldstein took his editing expertise was also a jam. So it was all one big jam.
Yeah, I was jamming also.
Yeah. And by the way, Charles Miller was the lead vocalist on Lowrider.
Was he the well, there you are giving the credit over to him quite generously doing so. In the midst of all of that fun and what sounds like, you know, just great times and times that were dipping into music, you call the band War. It obviously has to do with the period of time that was there, Lonnie.
Well, yes. And we just pretty much turned around the war for peace. And instead of, first of all, it was controversy.
Mm.
It's controversial, just naming ourselves War. And because and like Jerry says, it drew attention, and that's how we got attention from people who didn't pay attention to us. War. So we took that concept, and instead of shooting bullets out at people, we just took our choice of weapons, which was our musical instruments, and shot out harmonies, rhythm, and the melodies, and it's still controversial today, to this very day.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's as relevant today as it was back in the 1970s, when the war that you were talking about then was obviously the Vietnam War and the soldiers who were coming home from that war and all of the trouble and controversies that it was causing at home in America, that is. For you, Jerry, as a producer, were you courting controversy, or how anxious were you about that band name War?
Well, I thought it was perfect, actually. It's because Eric and I basically, you know, with the guys, came up with this thing, and we figured, because nobody would ever forget the name, you know, a band called War, you're not going to forget it. And that was our idea to, you know, there's a real consciousness about it, especially during the Vietnam War time. And everybody was saying peace and love. We felt that would be like, and Eric was like a contrarian anyway. So, you know, it was a perfect match for him, and it worked.
Yeah, and a band called Peace would have given a totally different flavor to it. War kind of makes a statement from the very outset. I'm thinking of just a couple of gigs that I want you to remember and stories that you might remember for us, Lonnie. Famously, you jammed with Jimi Hendrix the night before he died. What's your memory of that jamming session? And had you any sense on that night that he wouldn't be there the following day?
I didn't have any sense that he wouldn't be there. I didn't think so at all. It was definitely an experience for me, just like he said, are you experienced? Well, I was that night. and he put more experience into my brains. I learned a lot that night. We jammed for, I would say, 45 minutes to an hour on one song, you know. And he didn't bring any gadgets, you know. He just had a simple amplifier plugged it in, and we all just jammed and soloed all night. Everybody, every individual solo.
And what about, I mean, 45-minute jam with Jimi Hendrix? That's something else, I would have thought. And you all get solos in the midst of it. Then there was the time when, I don't know how much jamming you were doing, but you were certainly maybe being a bit too funky for your own good when you opened for Elton John. You stole the show, I think, yeah?
Yeah, that was the Meet 'Em show. That Meet 'Em was a convention in the south of France that all the record companies attended. Mm. And there was a gala every night, and every record company put one of their big stars on and one of their, you know, newcomers that they believe were going to be stars. Okay. So we were on the show because we were with United Artists, and we were supposed to close the show, and Elton John was on the show with us. So was Ike and Tina Turner. So there were a lot of big acts, and, you know, we told Elton not to follow us, you know, because we're on a hot burning tour. We're tearing it up. We're getting 5 encores a night. I mean, you don't really want to follow us. And Elton goes, no. I'm the guy who I'm the star. I have to close the show, you know. So we went, okay, if you want, that's fine. So we did our 20 minutes, and everybody was doing 20 minutes on Eurovision too. It was right. So we did our 20 minutes and this is the audience, about 1,000 people, but they're all industry people. Really tough to impress, right? They got up at the end of our set and wouldn't let us off the stage. It was like a regular gig, and we had to do an encore because they would have rioted. Okay. Yeah. So we went up. So Eric says, okay, we'll do an encore. So Eric decides to do a 20-minute version of Tobacco Road. Okay.
So 20 minutes became 40 minutes very quickly. But listen.
Yeah, exactly. And Elton tore his bow tie off his neck and said, Eric Burden, I'm never going to talk to you. And he ran back to the hotel and never performed. Okay.
Well, listen.
That's what happened.
Right, it makes me wonder how long the gig is going to be when you get to the Academy. People better bring sandwiches and tea with them because there'll be loads of long jamming sessions. But you know what I want to do? I want to finish up with, and maybe Lonnie, you can lead us into this, because I think the track "Why Can't We Friends?" Why Can't We Be Friends? From it's the title track from the album that was so important for you guys. It touches on the multi-race nature of the band itself. And it's as, again, a bit like the title War, it's as useful a song today as it would have been 50 years ago.
Yeah. Well, everyone in the band brought to the table their own conversation of expressing peaceful thoughts on record. That's what we did. And actually, I always say, our fans, our Rock and Roll Hall of Fans, they give us the strength and the tools and the pen to actually write songs because we're connected with the people. So that's what it's all about. We're all one.
Well, listen, lovely to speak with both of you, Lonnie Jordan, Jerry Goldstein of War. Thanks for being with us this evening. And let's finish up with a little bit of Why Can't We Be Friends? Great question to ask yourself. Why can't we be friends? Lonnie Jordan and Jerry Goldstein of War speaking to me there. You can see War live on Wednesday the 2nd of July at the Academy in Dublin. And I'm sure it'll be a much longer version of Why Can't We Be Friends than the little bit we just heard. You can find out full details of the gig on mcd.ie. Composer Natalia Bayliss's latest composition, Etched on a Stone, is a sonic journey inspired by the Atlantic Ocean. Natalia has lived near the ocean on both sides, both the US side and the Irish side. And in Etched on a Stone, she uses field recordings gathered over a decade on Ireland's coastlines, brings the sea's rhythm to life using instruments, electronics and objects gathered from the water's edge. Etched on a Stone was commissioned by the Carja Festival and will have its world premiere at the Factory Performance Space in Sligo on July the 9th. And delighted to have Natalia join us on the line now. The sound of the sea, it's such an evocative sound, Natalia, and you certainly use it quite a bit in this Etched on a Stone composition of yours. How long have you been recording the sounds of the Atlantic Ocean, and when did you know that this was going to form into a piece at some point?
I've been recording the sounds of the Atlantic for, I'd say, about 12 or 13 years or so. That's probably how long I've been interested in field recording itself. But I've definitely been enchanted by the sound for much longer than that, sitting on seasides and just pulled into that rhythmic drone that you get on the side of when you're sitting by the ocean. The piece itself has been coming together for just over a year now. Mm. Carja approached me last year. They invited me to do a commission. And ever since then, it's been just rotating around in my brain and the thoughts of what it's all going to come together to be.
You've lived on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, as I've said, in the US and obviously here in Ireland as well. Does the ocean sound differently if you're in America? The Atlantic Ocean, does it sound different? Is it a very different sound if you record it in Ireland? And is it a different experience? Do you experience the ocean very differently on both sides?
Well, the closest place where I lived in the United States, the closest oceans to us were quite long sandy beaches, and there were quite calm oceans. Whereas often in Ireland, I find the oceans, the sounds of them can be quite momentous. They're, you know, I feel like you get the Atlantic here coming at you in a much more powerful way than sort of, I was along the eastern seaboard around Maryland and it was always quite calm. But here it's, I think the sea can be a lot louder and noisier here in a great way.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that means then, is it predominantly Irish Atlantic Ocean sounds that we hear in Etched on a Stone?
Yeah, it sounds from all across Ireland's shores, and just sounds I've recorded in Ireland. So everywhere from Rosnallen, Donegal, down to Clare, White Strand and Clare, and Cork. I have recordings from the caves in Cushendun in Antrim, recordings from Greystones, recordings from up in Falkara, up at the top as well. So
You even have sounds here that aren't necessarily the Atlantic Ocean. If you're over in Greystones, you've got the Irish Sea in there, I suppose. In there, but that would bring its own set of images and set of sounds. Let's have a listen to a little piece of the work, and certainly we'll hear the sound of the sea at the beginning, and then further instruments joining in the section that we have. We'll talk to you a little bit about those afterwards. Just a little section there from the composition Etched on a Stone, Natalia Bayliss, composer, speaking to me this evening ahead of the world premiere of the piece at the Carja Festival in Sligo. So we clearly could hear the sounds of the sea there, Natalia. What other instruments and sounds did we hear there, and are there involved in the piece itself?
For that short clip, the other sounds are there's cello played by Ema Reedy, who plays on the piece. And then there's some short clips of some synthesized sounds recorded on a mellotron, which I'm playing. For the performance itself, Ema will be there. I'll also have a French violinist named Agathe Max is coming over to join us. Tara Boy Mooney, who's based in Sligo, and then Willie Stewart on percussion. Tara's going to be playing a mix of harmonium, shruti box, and objects collected from along the shoreline. So she's going to have kind of seashells and sand and stones that she'll be making kind of different sonic landscape sounds with.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned Rosnaula earlier in our conversation. You spent some time on Rosnaula with the musicians. Was it there that you came across the Hagstone? You might explain what a Hagstone is and the kind of the it sounds to me almost like a vision that you were having while looking through the hole in this Hagstone.
There is. It was actually Tara and Emer who are playing on the piece with me that introduced me to hagstones. Basically, hagstones are, it's a stone with a hole in it that you find along the water's edge. And when you look through the hole, you're supposed to be able to see into another dimension, which it's a lovely thought that you can kind of look through something and have a way to get your brain to think differently about what you're seeing, which is kind of how I see hagstones. But they're all over the ocean's edge. You can just kind of go along and find them.
And did you have did you have any sense of that, seeing into another dimension?
I did with this piece. A lot of what this piece was based on was ideas around migration, ideas about my own kind of migration. I was born in Ukraine and we moved across to the States. And then I moved back over the Atlantic to Ireland. So spending time on the water's edge had me thinking a lot about migration, a lot about, you know, Irish migration and people leaving Ireland's shores and moving elsewhere, and people who came here and have been coming here all through the centuries, and ideas around migration and how, when we do migrate somewhere new, how we can find a way to come to a sense of belonging in that new place that we migrate to.
Yeah, your own story is interesting in that respect. When people hear you migrated from Ukraine, we should point out not during the current conflict in Ukraine. This was quite a while back. I think you were quite young when you moved from Ukraine to the United States. What was the reason? Was it a straightforward migration, that one, if such a thing exists in the world of migration, straightforward?
Yeah, I would have been a baby, so I wouldn't have had much choice. But I think for my parents, it was economic betterment. I think they just saw better opportunities kind of over in a new place. So that's what took me over the first time.
And then you migrated back across the Atlantic Ocean, back towards Europe, but you came as far as Ireland and, for the most part, I think, stuck to the west coast of Ireland. So, you know, you moved from one side literally to the other. That was a very different experience, I would guess.
Yeah, I did that as an adult, so that was much more my own choice. And that was, I met an Irish man over in America and followed him over here, so that's what brought me to Ireland. But I think no matter what causes people to migrate, whether it's for love or financial reasons, or, you know, due to reasons that are quite a bit more, you know, more bleak and don't necessarily come from their own choices. I think for everyone, when you do come somewhere new, you really do want to find a way to get that sense of belonging to this new place, to find a way to relate to the landscape, to relate to the people around you. And for me, this piece was a way of trying to find that sense of belonging and to really try to think of my place in Ireland and what can I bring to Ireland myself and with my experiences and with this piece as well.
To what extent would you say that the current migrations, you know, because of the current conflict, the current migrations from Ukraine, have you spoken to maybe those who have had to make that type of migration? And do you think that has fed into the piece in any way?
Definitely. I think, you know, people coming, it's been really interesting for a long time. There wasn't many other Ukrainians that I would encounter, or people born in Ukraine that I would encounter in Ireland. And recently, of course, so many people have moved here. Their experiences are so different than mine. But I have friends I have friends definitely have kind of migrated to Ireland from all over the world, from other friends from the States. I've had friends who've had to move here from Syria, and people just coming from very different situations. And I find that for everyone, everyone seems really happy when they end up in Ireland. I think that's one thing that I find across the board. In general, people find it's a place that does open itself up to people who want to try to find a way to belong here and find a way to become a part of life here and give you know, give something of themselves and become part of the fabric of society, which is, I think it's nice to think of that. It's, the Irish people are quite a welcoming people.
Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us this evening, Natalia. That's Natalia Bayliss, and her latest composition, Etched on a Stone, commissioned by the Carja Festival, will have its world premiere, as I said, at the Factory Performance Space in Sligo on July the 9th. And you can find out full details on carjafestival.com. Films tomorrow evening, by the way, F1 the movie, Brad Pitt and Kerry Condon, our own Kerry Condon. We'll be reviewing that, as we will Megan. This is the story of an AI robot, the young girl she befriends, and a New Zealand drama, The Moon is Upside Down. Three very different women, I think it's safe to say. A duped mail order bride, what's referred to as a numbed anaesthetist determined to have a romantic weekend, and an empty nester. You can find out more about those three movies and much else besides on tomorrow night's Arena. But that is it for Wednesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. John Byrne was the broadcast coordinator. Paul Murnoch was on sound this evening, and the programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.